The Guardian.
Hello, Ian Sample here. And before we get started with today's edition of Science Weekly, I'd like to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show.
What do our genes actually tell ourselves to do? We have 20,000 genes, but actually they make many more proteins and RNA molecules than that. And that's how we get a lot of bang for our biological buck. Genes are more like kind of suggestions for the cells how to go about, with a basic recipe, adaptations that you can make from that.
There are over 2 metres of DNA inside every one of our cells, encoding roughly 20,000 genes. These genes are the recipes instructing cells how to make the building blocks of life, along with control switches to turn them on and off at the right time. It's a major challenge to explore how it all works, and one person tackling it head-on is Kat Arney in her new book, Herding Hemingway's Cats. Kat's with me in the studio. Joining us from Edinburgh is Chris Ponting from the Medical Research Council, and from Cambridge we have Ewan Burney, Joint Director of the European Bioinformatics Institute and previously part of the ENCODE Consortium, a research project aimed at identifying all the functional elements in the human genome. Welcome to you all. Kat, perhaps we can start with you. Recent research revealed that only a tiny percentage of the British public really understands even the simplest terms that are used in genetics. What are the mistakes and what are the problems that people have with genetics?
Well, it's a really big challenge because we hear about genes all the time. You know, we hear about them in the papers. They make your eyes blue. They make your hair curl. You know, they're responsible for alcoholism, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, all these kinds of diseases. And there is a really poor understanding of what genes actually are, what they do, and how they work. And I think one of the biggest problems is the idea of this language of a gene for. There's a gene for Alzheimer's or a gene for schizophrenia. And that's really, really misleading, and it leads to a lot of confusion. And of course, everyone is fascinated by genetics. As soon as you start talking about genes, people go, oh, well, my mum had this and my granny was like that. So does that explain why me and my sisters are like this? We're so interested in what makes us us and the interplay between nature and nurture, you know, the genes that we get and then the environment that shapes us. The problem, as I see it, is that it's very poorly communicated in the media, and also it's really kind of poorly taught at schools. They learn a lot about what DNA is, how the molecular gene works. Genes are instructions that tell our cells to make proteins. But how it all fits together and what it actually does and what we know and what we don't know, I think is a bit of a mystery to many people.
Perhaps we could talk a bit there about, you know, what actually is our DNA, what's it made of, and what, you know, what are these different components?
There's been a lot of research into what's in the genome. That's the kind of sum total of all your DNA. There's a lot of confusion about nomenclature. What is a genome? What are chromosomes? Chromosomes are long strings of DNA in your cell. You don't have just one massive strand of DNA. It would all get tangled up and be very difficult to work with. So we have 23 pairs of chromosomes, long strings of DNA. Within those, there are roughly 20,000 honest-to-God genes. And genes are effectively recipes. They tell our cells to make different things, usually proteins, but sometimes just a molecule called RNA, which is like a message that's read off DNA. But the actual, in terms of amount of our DNA that is genes, is less than 2%. It's tiny. So people say, oh, well, what's all the rest? Is it junk? Is it the control switches that turn our genes on and off? Is it rubbish? What's it doing there? So that's a lot of the kind of questions that people like Ewan and the ENCODE Consortium and other researchers in genetics are trying to figure out. But yeah, what do our genes actually tell ourselves to do? We have 20,000 genes, but actually they make many, 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 many more proteins and RNA molecules than that. And that's how we get a lot of bang for our biological buck. We actually make many more molecules than just those 20,000, but those are the basic recipes. But like a recipe for a cake might say, oh, well, you could put in oranges, or you could put in lemons, or you could add a bit more or a bit less. Genes are more like kind of suggestions for the cells how to go about, with a basic recipe, adaptations that you can make from that.
One of the things you touched on there was this notion of sort of junk DNA, which is we're going to get into in a bit more depth with Chris and Ewan in a minute. When I was at school, we were told that this was junk. And since then, as I've got older, the naming of that has changed and it's now sort of labelled as non-coding DNA, or at least that's sort of one suggestion. Why has there been this sort of change or this shift in how we view that part of our DNA?
Well, I'll leave it to the experts to really explain what's in there and the current thinking about that. But the term junk is broadly infuriating because it implies that either it's all there for no purpose at all and does nothing, where it patently isn't. You know, you have the genes, the recipes, and then some of that is the control switches, the instructions that make your genes work. Some of it is structural stuff that enables our chromosomes to be copied and divided and, you know, not to get degraded from the ends. Some of it, we just don't know what it is. Some of it is read into RNA. Some of it seems to be these transposons, these long dead viruses in our genome. Some of it's probably harmful, and some of it is just junk. But how we talk about the non-coding DNA is, it's very complex to get across, because what you don't want to get across is the idea is that it's all junk, and then suddenly you find that a bit of it does something and everyone's like, oh my God, it's not junk. Or you don't want to say it's all there for a purpose, because that sort of argues that everything in our genome is entirely designed and it's all there for a reason, whereas some of it is kind of just there from evolution and it's hard for evolution to get rid of it.
Yeah, and perhaps I can bring you in here. First of all, where does this this non-coding DNA come from? It seems a first thought about it would suggest that, well, if it's not serving a purpose, why is it still there? Why hasn't it been whittled out by evolution?
Well, so the first thing to say is we know that genes have to be switched on and off, and even in the smallest of genomes, the most sort of compact and elegant, they still need more than the protein coding genes, the 20,000 genes that were mentioned. So it's very clear that for complex organisms, even quite simple organisms, they need to switch genes on and off at the right time, and something has to handle where those switches are and be what interacts with it. But over on top of that, there are all sorts of other processes that happen in the genome, some of which we understand and some of which we don't. One of the cases that we understand is when a virus enters the genome and sort of just internalizes inside of the genome, becomes a sort of genomic parasite. So these are the transposons. They happily repeat themselves across the genome. Lots of different transposons have done that in lots of different genomes. And sometimes this leads to very, very big genomes. So that's one thing that we know happens. But there's probably other things that we really don't understand. And we do a lot of describing of both what these are in terms of their DNA sequence, but also what they are in terms of what other bits of biochemistry interact with parts of those genomes. So there's a kind of a big kind of cataloguing and description effort that we're still in the midst of at the moment.
So you were part of the ENCODE consortium that was looking at just sort of how much of our genome is actually doing useful stuff. Can you tell me a bit about the project?
Yeah, and also it's not just useful stuff. I mean, the useful implies this, that we understand what's going on. It was much more about cataloguing just what is happening in the genome without statements necessarily about how it's being used. And so the project is still running. There were three phases, a very early phase that looked at 1% of the genome, then a phase that ran looking at the whole genome but over a limited set of cell types and different things that we can study, and currently many more cell types are being looked at in detail. And I was heavily involved in the first and the second phases of this project.
One of the figures that many people have heard of from this project was that 80% of our genome is functional. I mean, that's obviously something that's come in for a lot of debate. What do you mean by functional? I mean, maybe that's a good place to start.
Yes, so a lot of the debate here ends up being around semantics. We actually use the phrase biochemically functional, or has a biochemical function. And we define that later on in our paper as being that we can observe some specific biochemical activity happening at that point of DNA. And a lot of people get hung up on the word function, and it's very clear from the arguments afterwards is that people started from different places here. It's actually, one can have a very long debate about that, and it's perhaps better to be more operationally defined. And that 80% is that we found a specific activity, biochemical activity, of some aspect of the genome across 80% of it. And something to stress is that that was over a limited set of cell types, so almost certainly across 100% of the genome, once we look at everything, probably nearly everything has something specific going on. And that goes to the problem here is much more about definitions and how one then interprets this data than necessarily this percentage figure. The percentage figure is not very useful.
Chris, you've also been looking at this problem, but from in a slightly different way, and you've been looking at what happens to our DNA in our cells. You come out with a sort of different figure. Again, this might just be down to semantics, that 8% has a clear purpose. Can you tell me a bit about this debate, sort of the angle that you're coming at it from, and why those figures are so different?
Yes, the amount of the genome that matters to evolution should matter to us all in the general public. And that is because we should be interested in the proportion of the genome that, when there is a mutation that lands on it, actually causes us harm. The evolutionary perspective allows us to look back in time as to how often these mutations have occurred, and when they've not been good for the individual, they've been taken out of the population. My view is that by looking at evolution, you can have a direct view as to how much of the genome matters, rather than the amount of the genome for which there is some sort of activity.
So you're saying that parts of the genome might have some sort of activity, but if a mutation were to happen in those parts, it wouldn't be the end of the world for us.
Absolutely right. And so there are many switches that Ewan has just been talking about. Many of those switches will be biochemically active, but not all of them would have some sort of downstream consequence. They wouldn't turn on or off the lights, as it were.
I mean, is it thought that there are parts of our genome that are actually true garbage? I mean, are there actually parts which have just somehow, because they don't do us any harm, they've sort of been, you know, allowed to sort of hang around, as it were, by evolution, but that they don't actually have any discernible, handy purpose at all?
I would expect us all to agree on that there are plenty of parts of the genome, the human genome and many other genomes, which are inert, don't actually convey any particular function. Not, as I said, not just for us, but for many other genomes. There are genomes that are 40 times the size of the human genomes, for example, the marbled lungfish. And I don't think we would seriously say that lungfish has 40 times more functional DNA than we do.
Ewan, what's your take on this?
I'm very much in agreement here. There's certainly regions of the genome which were created by these transposon processes, which happen in these storms. They happen at certain times in evolutionary time and then deposit all sorts of things, which then slowly degrade, and we can watch them degrade over evolutionary time. But there is some different nuances to some of this perspective. So one of the things is I totally agree that Chris's 8%, and sometimes it gets a bit higher, of evolutionary constraint is a really, really interesting a set of bases in the human genome, which we truly want to understand their function. One interesting problem is that when we look at things biochemically, it's not the case that we can distinguish the biochemical activity that happens away from these versus the biochemical activity that happens elsewhere. And certainly, there's likely to be some very recent times when these biochemical switches have come about and maybe have an effect in a very recent evolutionary time. Furthermore, for diseases like cancer or late-onset diseases, these are quite likely not to have an impact on your evolutionary selection. And certainly when cancer happens, the whole system gets rewired, and switches that were previously quite unimportant suddenly become important for that cancer. So to understand how all of the different bits of biology, including disease biology, that we want to look at happens, we really need to be open to many different places of the genome playing a role, including the ones which aren't under evolutionary selection. But I would certainly agree that the ones that are under evolutionary selection are by far the most interesting, or the most interesting ones to look at first. And the debate here tends to focus on the numbers, and I mean, I don't disagree with Chris's numbers. I'm pretty sure that Chris wouldn't agree with the number of the amount of biochemical activity we see across the genome. It's really about how we use this information to understand biology in more detail. And then there's also sort of slightly meta questions about where's the best place to do future research as well. But there's quite a lot of open debate in these areas, which is far more interesting than the sort of quoted percentage.
Kat, what's your view on this?
It's really fantastic to hear you and Chris discussing this, because it's exactly the kind of problems that I was grappling with in my book. And one of the really big challenges for understanding what the genome does is the problem of biological redundancy. So actually, there are kind of a lot of genes themselves that can substitute for each other, and there's a lot of parts of the genome, a lot of control switches that seem to be able to substitute for each other, or at least you can break quite a few of them before things start to go wrong, because evolution and life doesn't really care that you're doing everything absolutely perfectly right. It just cares that you're A, alive, B, get laid, and C, have babies. So that's kind of the really important stuff. And trying to unpick, for example, if you, because geneticists figure out how things work by breaking stuff, basically. So they would break a bit of the genome and say, what happens? But unless you hit it lucky, you can break a bit of the genome and nothing happens. You go, oh, well, was that important? I don't know. Mm. But it might be that if you then challenge those organisms in a particular way, you change their environment, you change the circumstances they're living in, you break, say, another gene or another control switch, then you might start to see something. And this is where we are really starting to grapple with how the genome, our genotype, links to how we come out, our phenotype, or its influence on health and disease. Because it's lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of bits all working together. Some are more important than others. Some can compensate for each other. And that, I think, is a massive challenge. And again, in communicating genetics, we need to move away from this idea that it's one gene broken in one way for one disease. It's incredibly complicated. That doesn't mean we can't try and figure it out. And that's exactly what researchers are trying to do. But it's a much more nuanced and complex picture than I think many people, and certainly many lay listeners, might imagine.
Chris, how do we pick apart some of these nuances? I mean, as Kat was saying, there are lots of genes that could do the same job as other genes, or regions of DNA that could do the same job as other regions of DNA. How do you even start to tease that apart?
Well, I think one of the important ways of teasing it apart is exactly what Kat said, in that we try and break things. Then we see how important various elements are. And the different approach that the ENCODE project used is that instead of breaking things, they just observed whether things stuck together or not. The problem with that is that there are many molecules, many proteins, many RNAs, which are just inherently sticky. They will stick to one another, and if you then infer from that because two things are stuck together, that they are meant in some way to have some function together, that's not necessarily true. What you do need to do is to go in and disrupt that interaction, ask what consequences it has. And to me, the lens of evolution provides that, because through evolution there have been so many breakages that have occurred, and when they've been very severe, of course, those breakages have not been recorded in current DNA. To me, is the difference of opinion between the sticky biochemistry, which I don't think is necessarily informative, and the evolutionary way of observing the breakages that have occurred across the millennia.
So would it be fair to say that you see that this stickiness or this association between DNA and some other molecules is not necessarily evidence of sort of true, useful biological activity?
So there have been studies that have shown this, that it is in fact the minority of binding events of proteins on DNA that cause a change in how active genes are.
Ewan, would you like to come in there? This sounds like a good point to bring you back in.
Absolutely. And again, setting this up as a disagreement is quite interesting. So Chris knows that I'm a big fan of looking at evolutionary changes, and in the paper we did quite a careful piece of analysis that absolutely agreed that many of the biochemical events that we observed looked like they were under neutral selection. So in other words, evolution didn't care really whether they're there or not. But it's still interesting. It's interesting to study these things because they're indistinguishable from the ones that evolution does care about, and so that's an interesting fact. They sit alongside genes in a similar way, so it's not that there's some way of distinguishing what is happening biophysically about these things. And furthermore, as I mentioned, there are other things which evolution doesn't necessarily get to probe and see, such as the progression to cancer or the development of late onset diseases, which we're also interested in. So I'm a pluralist in this. I enjoy using evolutionary analysis and seeing how evolution breaks things. In the ENCODE paper, we also did a number of specific experiments where we introduced the elements we discovered into, example, fish and mice, and showed that they showed the same activity in fish and mice as we saw in the human system. It doesn't mean that they're meaningful, but it shows that what we've discovered, what we predicted to discover, can be confirmed by orthogonal experiments. And then I think it is useful to understand the biochemical properties of different parts of DNA, partly because there's still a lot of things that we don't understand inside of this. So that's not to, you know, challenge anything that's coming from Chris about the evolutionary analysis, which I think is fascinating, interesting, and has to be used and integrated.
So one of the things that I want to pick up on is something that was mentioned earlier, was this idea that what we think might be not terribly useful DNA can sort of become useful. So you mentioned there in the case of cancer. How often is it that the functional or purpose of a seemingly non-coding DNA can change and actually then produce some effect?
Well, this is one of those somewhat open questions when one gets into things like cancer. What we do know is cancer very often involves sort of quite cataclysmic rewiring events where all sorts of things change across the genome. And rather innocuous-looking things previously can suddenly be reused in all sorts of ways for sort of nefarious uses by the cancer sometimes. Now, that doesn't mean that everything can be reused in that way, but it does tell you that our genomes are big, complex places with lots of different things going on, and sometimes the way that they go wrong is as important to understand as the kind of the way that they went right over evolution to make one of us.
Kat, did you want to come in there?
Yeah, there was a few examples of some of these kind of things happening that I looked at in my book. And one is the example of how the control switches that turn genes on and off at the right time in the right place, they can get changed and have really quite profound effects on organisms. And there's a really nice paper from some researchers at the Cambridge Research Institute showing that these control switches are really changing quite rapidly between species through evolution. And a couple of examples I look at in my book is the Hemingway cats of the book's title, Herding Hemingway's Cats. They have a little change in a control switch that means that they have thumbs. And some sticklebacks, where you change a control switch and suddenly sticklebacks that live in the lakes have no pelvis and no protective spikes compared to sticklebacks that live in the sea. So by fiddling with these switches, you can get some really profound changes in organisms, and it's a playground for evolution. But then there are also other examples of things like pseudogenes. These are long dead genes. They're thought to be, you know, completely useless. They've come from a copy of a gene that somehow got broken. But we're starting to discover that messages can be read from them, and these influence the activity of other regular, not broken genes. And things like transposons, these viruses that can hop in and out of the genome, maybe some of them are hopping about and influencing how genes work. And I explore a few examples of this in the book. And that's because I really wanted to show people that it's not just about your basic genes being turned on and off, that there is all this stuff in the genome. There's a lot of biology going on with the RNA that's read from our DNA that people need to get a bit more of a grasp of.
Chris, perhaps this is a good time to bring in epigenetics. Perhaps you can explain to listeners a little bit about that effect. And what effect does that have on our DNA?
So the kinds of molecules that Kat's just been describing, which are the RNAs that have been produced from the genome, which don't make themselves make protein, are now being seen as tweaking and tuning the activity of the genome and genes. I think this is very important. There is a storm of RNA that's produced from our genome that doesn't eventually make protein. But I think it would be wrong to say that that storm of RNA is doing anything more than tuning the outcomes of what are indeed the major players out of the genome, which are the protein coding genes.
But in terms of epigenetics, so changes to our DNA which occur sort of after we're born, which happen as a result of our environment, does that also complicate this whole story a lot more?
Indeed. So our environment can write itself through epigenetics into the ways in which genes are able to be turned off and on. That experience affects the switching of genes as we develop and as we age. That's very important to understand, but I wouldn't get too hung up on the idea of epigenetics when it indeed it is the genetics that controls most of these phenomena.
Yes, as scientists we don't help ourselves here, because really there are at least three types of epigenetics which are quite different. So what you were mentioning there about the environment having a kind of memory in our bodies at some level, you might call that somatic cell state epigenetics, and that is around the extent to which environment really transmits things over time through that versus other mechanisms is interesting. But very clearly, for example, a liver cell has a strong memory that it's a liver cell even when it divides outside of your liver in a dish, and that memory is mediated by epigenetics. But there's another use of the word epigenetics, which often is the one used in the popular press, which is non-DNA-based transmission between generations. And that you would call transgenerational epigenetics. Now, that happens a lot in plants, or at least not a lot, but we study it regularly in plants. We know it happens in plants very regularly. It's actually been very elusive to nail down in mammals. There are one or two cases, but some of the best people I know in this are still struggling to work this through and find definitive proof. And one of the problems in mammals is that, in fact, all of us have DNA that was present in our maternal grandmother. And that's because the eggs in female mammals are created in the fetus. And so your mother's eggs were created when she was in your grandmother. And so there's quite a strong chain between the generations. I always find it amazing that my DNA, part of my DNA was present in my maternal grandmother's exposure, as it were. And then there's a third type of epigenetics called parent of origin epigenetics, which go into cats, more exotic types of epigenetics. So as a scientific community, I actually wish we had given three different names to these different things, because then it would be easier to know, more clear-cut, what we're talking about. And I find all three of them sort of fascinating, but certainly I would agree with Chris, which is that the end point of all of these processes are to change the building blocks, the proteins that make us. So there isn't a kind of a conflict between studies in epigenetics and genetics. In some sense, epigenetics is how our genetics gets expressed in us.
Kat, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I do find epigenetics is actually the kind of field that I worked in when I was a scientist, and I think it's a word that's so horrifically abused, particularly in the popular press. Really, the basic definition of epigenetics is from Conrad Waddington, decades and decades ago, and it's the idea that we have the same DNA in all the cells of your body. You have the same DNA in a liver cell, as a brain cell, as a skin cell, but they're making a very different suite of molecules. They look very different. So epigenetics in that sense, as Ewan kind of explained, is how cells switch on the right genes to be them and then remember it. People use the word epigenetics as if now it's some kind of word like quantum to explain things we don't really understand. it's epigenetic. And it is infuriating, especially to researchers in the field, because yes, of course, epigenetics in that sense is how your cells respond to the environment. They respond to the cells and the cues around them from development onwards to function properly and keep you healthy and alive and all this kind of stuff, and then when they start going awry you can get some diseases as a result of that. But yeah, then there's the kind of the weird stuff. There's the field I used to work in called genomic imprinting, where certain genes, if you get them from your mum, they might be switched on. If you get them from your dad, they're switched off, and vice versa. That's some kind of freaky weird stuff. And then this idea of transgenerational epigenetic inheritance, where perhaps the things that you do in your lifetime might be passed on. Mm. So, you know, we bring back the spectre of Lamarck. And there's some good stuff going on, particularly, as Ewan said, in plants and also in worms and some simple organisms. In humans, a lot more sketchy, but, you know, people want to use this as some kind of stick to beat parents with, or some kind of like, ooh, if you eat green tea or broccoli now, you could have healthier babies. And we really don't have the evidence to support that yet.
Chris, it seems that our understanding of genetics, the more we dig, the more questions we have and the more areas there are to probe. What would you say is the most important area which is being probed at the moment?
Transcriptional control. How the switches switch on and how those switches themselves are controlled.
And Ewan?
For me, I think a really interesting thing is how more than one region of the genome controls variation we see. So we know that multiple genes feed into things like, simple things like height that you can measure, but we don't really understand how that integration happens or the sort of mechanics of it, both biochemically but also statistically. And so I'm very interested in how multiple genes work together.
Kat, what would you say is the hot topic?
I think I'd kind of agree with that and build on Ewan's idea a bit. So there's a lot of talk in the field of genetics about the idea of missing heritability. So from twin studies, for example, looking at identical twins, you're trying to ask how similar are identical twins in certain traits or disease risks compared to fraternal twins or brothers and sisters or non-related individuals. And we do find that for many, many traits and diseases, there's lots and lots and lots and lots of bits of the genome that we can link to certain traits, certain diseases, but it doesn't all add up to the explanation. Some of it is going to be the influence of the environment, obviously. Some of it is what we call missing heritability, and there's different ideas. If we carry on looking for genes, if we carry on stratifying populations that we look at, maybe we'll find more and more of these variations and it'll add up a bit more. I think that there are probably other factors at work and the influence of the environment. So really the future, I think, is unpicking the nature and the nurture, how it all works together, how the genotype, our genome, leads to the phenotype, how we come out, and our risk of all sorts of different diseases and the traits that we have. I think it's an incredibly exciting time to be writing about genetics, to be working in genetics and talking about it to the public, because this is the stuff we're all going to have to grapple with in the not too distant future.
Thanks very much. That's all we have for you this week. Herding Hemingway's Cats, Understanding How Our Genes Work, is published now by Bloomsbury. A big thank you to Kat Arney, Ewan Burney and Chris Ponting. From me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
Men of Science Weekly, we've teamed up with our friends at Cornerstone to give you an offer that'll save you time, money and give you a closer shave. With Cornerstone, you'll never have to worry about your blades being blunt again. They'll deliver their super sharp, award-winning German engineered razors right to your door. Just visit cornerstone.co.uk/scienceweekly, enter your initials so they can be engraved on the heavy-duty aluminium handle and pick the delivery scheme that suits you best. And because you listen to Science Weekly, Cornerstone are giving you £10 of your first order. And if you're not 100% satisfied, Cornerstone will give you your money back with no questions asked. Head to cornerstone.co.uk/scienceweekly and discover an even better way to shave, starting from as little as £4. That's cornerstone.co.uk/scienceweekly.